Oh, he says, let's cut the crap, Daisy. You need to record this album or Runner's taking you to court. I said, I don't care about any of that. They can take their money back, get me kicked out of here if they want. I'll live in a cardboard box. I was very annoying. I had no idea what it meant to truly suffer. Teddy said, just get in the studio, love. How hard is that? I told him, I want to write my own stuff. I think I even crossed my arms in front of my chest like a child. He said, I've read your stuff. Some of it's really good, but you don't have a single song that's finished. You don't have anything ready to be recorded. He said I should fulfill my contract with Runner and he would help me get my songs to a point where I could release an album of my own stuff. He called it a goal for us all to work toward. I said, I want to release my own stuff now. And that's when he got testy with me. He said, do you want to be a professional groupie? Is that what you want? Because the way it looks from here is that you have a chance to do something of your own and you'd rather just end up pregnant by Bowie. Let me take this opportunity to be clear about one thing. I never slept with David Bowie. At least I'm pretty sure I didn't. I said, I am an artist, so you either let me record the album I want, or I'm not showing up, ever. Teddy said, Daisy, someone who insists on the perfect conditions to make art isn't an artist. They're an asshole. I shut the door in his face. And sometime later that day, I opened up my songbook and I started reading. I hated to admit it, but I could see what he was saying. I had good lines, but I didn't have anything polished from beginning to end. The way I was working then, I'd have a loose melody in my head and I'd come up with lyrics to it and then I'd move on. I didn't work on my songs after one or two rounds. I was sitting in the living room of my cottage, looking out the window, my songbook in my lap, realizing that if I didn't start trying, I mean being willing to squeeze out my own blood, sweat, and tears for what I wanted, I'd never be anything. Never matter much to anybody. I called Teddy a few days later. I said, I'll record your album. I'll do it. And he said, it's your album. And I realized he was right. The album didn't have to be exactly my way for it still to be mine.
Simone. One day when I was back in town, I went over to Daisy's place at the Marmont and I was in the kitchen and I saw one piece of paper with a bunch of lyrics scribbled on it, taped to the fridge. I said, what's this? Daisy said, it is my song that I'm working on. I said, don't you normally have dozens? She shook her head and said, I'm trying to get this one just right.
It was a big lesson for me when I was young, being given things versus earning them. I was so used to being given things that I didn't know how important it is for your soul to earn them. If I can thank Teddy Price for anything, and to be honest, I have to thank him for a lot of things, but if I had to pick one, it's that he made me earn something. And that's what I did. I showed up at the studio. I tried to stay relatively sober. And I sang the songs they told me to sing. I didn't sing them the way they wanted all the time. I gave a little pushback. And I do think the album is better for my having held on to a little bit of my own style. But I did what was asked of me. I played the game. And when we were done, 10 ballads and a pretty little package, Teddy said, how do you feel? And I told him I felt like I'd made something that wasn't exactly what I'd envisioned, but it was maybe good in its own right. I said it felt like me, but it didn't feel like me, and I had no idea whether it was brilliant or awful or somewhere in between. And Teddy laughed and said I sounded like an artist. I liked that. I asked him what we should call it, and he said he didn't know. I said, I want to call it First. because I plan on making a lot more of these.
Nick Harris. Daisy Jones put out first at the beginning of 1975. They marketed her as a Dusty Springfield wannabe. On the cover, she's looking in a mirror placed over a pale yellow background. It wasn't groundbreaking material by any means, but looking back on it, you can start to see the grit and the edge under the surface. Her first single, a version of One Fine Day, was more complex than most other takes of the song, and her second single, she recorded a take of My Way Down, was warmly received. I mean, the album is fairly middle of the road, but it did what it needed to do. People knew her name. She did a spot on American Bandstand. She did a great spread in Circus with her trademark hoop earrings. She was gorgeous and outspoken and interesting. The music wasn't there yet, but you knew Daisy Jones was heading somewhere. Her moment was coming.
Seven, eight, nine, 1975 to 1976. Fresh out of rehab and at home with Camila and his new daughter, Billy Dunn started writing songs again. When he had enough material, the six got back into the studio to record their second album. From June to December of 1975, the six recorded the 10 songs that would become 7, 8, 9. But when the band was done, Teddy told them that Rich Palantino did not feel confident they had a number one single on the album.
Billy, it felt like being cut off at the knees. We were ready to go. We were proud of that album.
Eddie, to be honest with you, I was surprised Teddy had not brought this up sooner. I heard the master of the album, and it felt soft to me, at least in terms of what we were making songs about. Everything Billy had written was about his family. Pete said it best. Rock and roll is about getting it on with a girl for the first time, not about making love to your wife. And that was Pete saying that. He was as whipped as Billy.
Graham, I told Teddy we had a lot of songs that could be singles. I said, what about Hold Your Breath? He said, too slow. I said, what about Give In? He said, too hard rock. I kept naming songs, and Teddy kept saying that Rich was right. The songs were good, but we needed something with crossover appeal. He said we had to aim for number one. Our first album had done well, but if we wanted to grow, we needed to aim higher. I said, sure, but we aren't trying to get to number one, necessarily. That's for lowest common denominator stuff. Teddy said, you should be aiming to be number one because you're making the greatest fucking music out there. It was a fair point.
I don't remember whose idea it was to do a duet. I know I wouldn't have come up with it.
When Teddy said he thought we should make Honeycomb a duet, I was even more confused. He was going to take the softest song on the album, add a female vocal to it, and that was going to fix the problem? That just made it even more of a top 40 thing. I said to Pete, I will not be in a fucking soft rock band.
Honeycomb is a romantic song, but it's also kind of wistful. I'd written it about the life that I promised Camila. She wanted to move to North Carolina one day when we were old and settling down. Her mother had grown up there. She wanted to get a place close to the water, have a big lot of land with the closest neighbor a mile away. It was a pledge I'd made her, that I would give her that one day, a big farmhouse, lots of kids, some peace and quiet after all the storms I'd put her through. That's what Honeycomb was about. It didn't make any sense to have someone else come in on it. And Teddy disagreed. He said, write a part for a woman in it. Write what Camila would say back to you.
I thought we should give Karen a shot at the duet. She had a great voice.
I don't have the kind of voice that can carry a lead part. I can do you a solid and back you up in the chorus, but I can't hold my own.
Warren. Graham was always tripping over himself to pay Karen a compliment. I was always thinking, it's not gonna happen for you, man. Get over it.
Teddy had all these ideas about bringing in a woman from the dance club scene. I did not like that.
Teddy named about 10 girls until Billy finally relented. I watched it happen. Billy was going down the list Teddy had written, just going, no, 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 Tanya Reading? No. Susie Smith? No. And then Billy goes, who's Daisy Jones? And Teddy got all amped up, said he was hoping Billy would ask that because he thought Daisy was the one.
Graham. Now, I'd heard Daisy sing at the Golden Bear a few months back. I thought she was sexy as hell. Her voice was so raspy and cool, but I didn't think she fit on the record. She was younger, poppier. I said to Teddy, why can't you get us Linda Ronstadt? Everybody had a thing for her back then. But Teddy said it should be someone from our label. He said Daisy had a more commercial vibe that we could benefit from. I had to admit, I saw where Teddy was coming from. I said to Billy, if Teddy is trying to bring in a different demographic, Daisy makes sense.
Teddy wasn't letting up. Daisy, Daisy, Daisy. Even Graham started in on me. I said, fine. If this girl Daisy wants to do it, then we'll try it.
Rod. Teddy was a good producer. He knew people in town were just starting to get excited about Daisy Jones. If this song turned out well, it could make a splash.
I had heard of the Six, obviously, being on the same label and everything. And I'd heard their singles on the radio. I hadn't bothered to listen to their debut album that much, but when Teddy played me 7, 8, 9, I was blown away. I love that album. I must have listened to Hold Your Breath about 10 times in a row. I loved Billy's voice. There was something so plaintive about it, so vulnerable. I thought, this is the voice of a man who's seen things. I thought it was so evocative to sound broken the way he did. I didn't have that. I sounded like a cool new pair of jeans, and Billy sounded like the pair you've had for years. I could see the potential of how we could really complement each other. So I kept listening to their cut of Honeycomb, and I could feel something missing. I read the lyrics, and I really got that song. This felt like my shot to offer something up, to add something. I was excited to get in the studio because I thought I could really be of use.
We were all there in the studio that day when Daisy came in, and I thought everybody but me and Teddy should have gone home.
I was going to wear one of my Halstons, and then I woke up late and lost my keys and couldn't find my pill bottle, and the morning got away from me.
Karen, when she showed up, she was wearing a men's button-down shirt as a dress. That was it. I remember thinking, where are her pants?
Eddie, Daisy Jones was the most gorgeous woman I ever laid eyes on. She had those big eyes, those super full lips. She was as tall as I was. She looked like a gazelle.
Warren. Daisy had no ass, no tits. A carpenter's dream, as they call them. Flat as a board, easy to nail. Well, I don't know if she was easy to nail. Probably not. The way men reacted to her, she held all the cards and she knew it. When Pete saw her, he might as well have let his tongue roll out of his mouth.
She was so pretty that I worried I was staring at her. But then I thought, hell, she's probably been stared at her whole life. She probably thinks looking means staring.
I saw her, and I introduced myself, and I said, glad to have you here. Thanks for helping us out. I asked if she wanted to talk about the song a bit, or practice what she was going to lay down.
I'd been working on it all night. I'd been in the studio with Teddy a few days before, listening to it over and over. I had a good idea of what I wanted to do.
Daisy just said, no thanks. Like that, like I had nothing of value to offer.
She went right into the booth and started warming up.
I said, guys, we don't all need to be here watching her, but nobody moved.
I finally had to say, can I have some room to breathe, please?
Finally, everybody started funneling out, except me, Teddy, and Artie.
Artie Snyder. I mic'd her up in one of the ISO booths. We did a couple test runs, and for whatever reason, the mic wasn't working. It took me about 45 minutes to get that mic going. She was standing there, singing into it on and off, going, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, helping me out. I could feel Billy getting more and more tense, but Daisy was so calm about it. I said, I'm sorry about this, and she said, it takes as long as it takes, and you'll get it when you get it. Daisy always did right by me. She always made it seem like she cared about how my day was going. Not a lot of people did that.
I had read the lyrics to the song what felt like a million times. I had my own idea of how I wanted it to go. Billy sang it in this sort of pleading way. I thought the way he sang it made it seem like he wasn't sure he believed his own promise. And I loved that. I thought that made it so interesting. So I had this plan to sing my part like I wanted to believe him, but maybe deep down inside I didn't. I thought that gave the song some layers. When we got the mic working, you know, Artie's giving me the signal to start and Billy and Teddy are watching me, I got up into the mic and I sang it like I didn't believe Billy was going to buy a house near the honeycomb. That it wasn't really ever gonna happen. That was my angle on it. During the refrain, the lyrics were originally, the life we want will wait for us. We will live to see the lights coming off the bay. And you will hold me, you will hold me, you will hold me until that day. I sang it straight through on the first go around. But the second time I sang it, I changed it up a bit. I said, will the life we want wait for us? Will we live to see the lights coming off the bay? Will you hold me? Will you hold me? Will you hold me until that day? I sang them as questions, as opposed to statements. Billy didn't even let me finish before he popped up and hit the talk back.
She sang the words wrong. Didn't make sense to have her keep going with the words wrong.
Artie Snyder. Billy would never have allowed someone to interrupt him like that. I was genuinely surprised when he did that.
The song was about a happy ending, after turmoil. I didn't think doubt worked in that context.
Billy wrote that song trying to convince himself that this future he saw with Camila was a sure thing. But he and Camila both knew Billy could relapse at any moment. I mean, the first month he was out of rehab, he gained 10 pounds because he was eating chocolate bars in the middle of the night. And then when he stopped doing that, there was all this woodworking. You'd go over to Billy and Camila's, and Billy would be obsessing over some mahogany dining room table he was trying to make, and there were all these shitty dining chairs he'd nailed together. And don't get me started on the shopping. Oh, and the running was maybe the worst of it. For about 2 months, Billy would run however many miles a day. He'd be wearing those little dolphin shorts and muscle tanks, bobbing down the street.
Rod. Billy was trying. This was a guy who made so many things seem easy, but he was trying very hard to stay sober, and you could see the strain on him.
Billy was writing songs trying to tell himself he had got it all under control. That decades out, he'll still have his sobriety and his wife and his family.
Daisy did a few more takes, and it really seemed easy for her. She didn't have to work for it. She wasn't bleeding for every note. But when Billy left the studio, I could tell he was pretty tense. I said, don't take work home with you. But the problem wasn't that he had brought work home with him. It was that he had brought home into work.
Honeycomb used to be a song about security, and it became a song about insecurity.
That night I told Camila about how Daisy sang it, with the questions. You know, Camila's got her hands full with Julia, and I'm talking her ear off, complaining about this song. She just said, it's not real life, Billy. It's a song. Don't get bent out of shape. It was so simple for her. I should just get over it. But I couldn't get over it. I did not like that Daisy turned those lines into questions, and I didn't like that she had felt the right to do it.
Camila, when you put your life in your music, you can't be clear-headed about your music.
Graham, I think Daisy was just very unexpected for Billy.
Artie Snyder. When we cut together the version with Daisy, it was so compelling, their voices together, that Teddy wanted to strip almost everything else away. He had me soften the drums a bit, amp up the keys, cut out some of Graham's more distracting flourishes. What we were left with was this sprawling acoustic guitar and percussive piano. Most of the attention went to the vocals. The song became entirely about the relationship of the voices. I mean, it moved. It was still up-tempo, it still had a rhythm, but it was eclipsed by the vocal. You were hypnotized by Billy and Daisy.
Eddie, they took a rock song and they made it a pop song. And they were so pleased with themselves about it.
Rod, Teddy was over the moon with how it turned out. I liked it too, but you could see the way Billy bristled as he listened to it.
I liked the new mix, but I did not like Daisy's vocals. I said just do the new mix without her vocals. It doesn't need to be a duet. Teddy just kept telling me I had to trust him. He said that I had written a hit song and that I had to let him do his thing.
Graham, Billy was always in charge, you know. Billy wrote the lyrics, Billy composed and arranged all the songs. If Billy goes to rehab, the tour is over. If Billy is ready to go back to the studio, we all have to report for duty. He ran the show. So Honeycomb was not easy for him.
We were all a team.
Man, Billy was in such denial of what a bulldozer he was to the rest of us. Billy got Billy's way every time. And when Daisy showed up, he stopped getting his way every time.
I did not understand what Billy had against me. I came in, and I made the song just a little bit better. What was there to be upset about? I ran into Billy at the studio a few days later to hear the final cut, and I smiled at him. I said, hello. He just nodded his head at me, like he was doing me a favor by acknowledging my presence. He couldn't even extend a professional courtesy.
Karen, it was a man's world. The whole world was a man's world, but the recording industry, it wasn't easy. You had to get some guy's approval to do just about anything, and it seemed like there were two ways to go about it. You either acted like one of the boys, which is the way I had found, or you acted real girly and flirty and batted your eyelashes. They liked that. But Daisy, from the beginning, was sort of outside of all that. She was just sort of take me or leave me.
I didn't care if I was famous or not. I didn't care if I got to sing on your record or not. All I wanted to do was make something interesting and original and cool.
When I first started, I wanted to play the electric guitar, and my dad got me piano lessons instead. He didn't mean anything by it. He just thought the keys were what girls play. But it was stuff like that. Every time I tried anything. When I auditioned for the Winters, I had this really great mini dress I'd just bought. It was pale blue with a big belt across it. It felt like a lucky dress. Well, the day I tried out, I didn't wear it because I knew they'd see a girl, and I wanted them to see a keyboardist. So I wore jeans and a University of Chicago t-shirt I stole from my brother. Daisy wasn't like that. It would never have occurred to Daisy to do that.
I wore what I wanted when I wanted. I did what I wanted with who I wanted, and if somebody didn't like it, screw 'em.
You know how every once in a while you'll meet somebody who seems to be floating through life? Daisy sort of floated through the world, oblivious to the way it really worked. I suppose I probably should have hated her for it, but I didn't. I loved her for it, because it meant she was less inclined to take the shit I'd been taking for years now. And with her around, I didn't have to take that shit either.
Karen was the kind of person who had more talent in her finger than most people have in their whole body, and the Six was underutilizing her. She fixed that, though. She fixed that on the next one.
Billy, when the record was about to be pressed, I said to Teddy, you made me hate my own song. And Teddy said to me, you're going to need to work really hard at getting over yourself. Something tells me hitting the top of the charts is going to ease the sting a bit.
Nick Harris, rock critic. On Honeycomb, Billy and Daisy and the way they play off each other was the beginning of what works so well about Daisy Jones and the Six. The chemistry between their voices, his vulnerability, her fragility, it grabs you, it doesn't let go. With his voice deep and smooth and her voice higher and raspier, they somehow still meld together effortlessly, like two voices that have been singing together for ages. They created a deeply heartfelt call and response, a story of this romantic and idealized future that may never come to pass. The song verges on being a bit saccharine, but the end undercuts the sweetness just enough. It could have been the kind of song teens play at prom. Instead, we have a passionate testament to the fact that things don't always work out. 789 was a good album, in some ways a great album. It was more explicitly romantic than their debut, fewer allusions to sex or drugs. It still rocked, though. It had that driving rhythm section, those piercing riffs. But Honeycomb was the clear standout. Honeycomb showed the world that the Six could put out a first-class pop song. It was a pivot, to be sure, but it's the beginning of their rise to the top.
The Numbers Tour, 1976 to 1977. 789 was released on June 1, 1976. Honeycomb debuted at number 86, but was headed up the charts at a steady clip. The band, playing an unofficial residency of sorts at the Whiskey, was gearing up to headline their own national tour.
Graham. We hung out in L.A. for a while, perfecting our set. The songs were coming together on stage. I say that, but I guess I don't mean Honeycomb. Billy did a rendition of it without Daisy. He just lifted her half of it and sang it as he originally intended on the album. It was good, but you could feel a hole in it. It was missing something. The rest of the album was playing great, though. We were playing tight, every song, every note. We had it down. We were putting together a great show.
Billy. We had the same people coming to see us two or three nights a week sometimes, and the crowds were growing the more we played.
Rod. Billy should have invited Daisy to some of those LA shows. I told him that, but it was in one ear and out the other with him.
Simone. Daisy was frustrated they were excluding her. At least I got that impression when we talked, which wasn't as often anymore with all my touring, but I still made sure I knew what was going on with her. She did the same with me.
Karen. Daisy knew everybody at the Whiskey. She was more connected on the Strip than we were, so it was only a matter of time before she showed up.
Daisy. I wasn't trying to crash anything. If Billy didn't want to invite me to sing with them, that was fine, but I wasn't going to stay away just because they were playing my single without me. Also, I started sleeping with Hank, which wasn't a great move on my part, but to be blunt, I was drunk or high a lot of the time back then, and it's a bit hazy. I don't even think I was attracted to Hank or even liked him all that much. He was a little short, had a square jaw, but he had a nice smile, I guess. Really, he just seemed to be there all the time. Anyway, Hank and I had been out at the Rainbow, and as we were walking, some of his friends were standing outside the Whiskey. So we went in.
Graham nodded at me and pointed with his eyes to where she was on the floor. And then we saw Billy spot her, too.
Eddie. The whole time we were playing the Whiskey back then, almost every night, Billy'd have some sort of note on how I was playing. He was such a control freak. But Daisy showing up? He couldn't control that. And man, she looked good. She had on a tiny little dress. Girls didn't wear bras back then, and it's a crying shame that ever ended.
What was I gonna do? Not invite her to sing the song with me while she was standing right there? She forced my hand.
Graham. Billy said into the mic. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Daisy Jones here tonight. What do you all say we sing a song called Honeycomb for you?
I walked up to the mic as Billy was facing the audience, and I thought, does Billy Dunn ever wear shirts that aren't denim?
She came on the stage barefoot, and I just thought, what is this girl doing? Put some shoes on.
The band all kicked in, and I stood at the mic, waiting. The first line is Billy, so I just watched the people in the crowd as he started singing. I watched the way they watched him. He was a real showman. I don't know if he gets enough credit for that. People now talk about how good we were together, but I've seen Billy when he's just on his own, and that man is talented. He was born to be in front of a crowd.
When Daisy's part came in, I turned and looked at her and watched her sing. We hadn't rehearsed it. We'd never sung together. I was half expecting it to be a disaster, but after a second or two, I just watched her. She really did have a dynamite voice. She smiled almost the entire time she was singing. I think you can tell that when you're listening. It comes through. That's something Daisy was great at. You could hear her smile in her words.
I thought about changing the lyrics back on the second reprise. I knew Billy hated the way I had changed it to the questions. But just before I was about to start singing those lines, I thought, I'm not here to make Billy like me. I'm here to do my job. And I sang it the way it was on the track.
I cringed as I heard her sing it.
Karen. Daisy and Billy were standing right next to each other, singing into the same mic, and the way Billy would watch her as she sang, the way she'd watch him, it was intense.
We harmonized at the end together. It wasn't that way on the record. It just sort of happened that way.
I could tell as we were singing it that we had everybody. When the song finished, the crowd started screaming. Actually screaming.
I just knew at that show that we had something special. Just knew it. And it didn't matter how much of an asshole I thought Billy was. When you can sing like that with someone, there's a small part of you that feels connected to them. That sort of thing that gets under your skin and doesn't easily come out. Billy was like a splinter. That's exactly what he was like.
On the heels of their thrilling performance at the Whiskey, Runner announced that Daisy Jones would be the opening act on the Sixes World Tour, dubbed the Numbers Tour. Billy appealed to Rod, Teddy, and Rich Palantino to change their minds and drop Daisy from the ticket, but he was finally forced to agree to the billing when Teddy showed him that ticket sales were climbing rapidly. Holdover dates were being added to the itinerary. As the band and Daisy set out on tour, Honeycomb had just hit the top 20.
Billy, I wasn't focused on who was opening for us. I was focused on how to stay sober on the tour. It was my first time out on the road since rehab.
Camila, Billy was telling me how he was going to call me 3 times a day and keep a journal of everything he did, and I explained to him that I didn't want him proving himself to me. That would just add more pressure, which was the last thing he needed. He needed to know that I believed in him. I said, tell me what I can do to make it easier, not harder.
I decided to bring Camila and Julia out on the road with me. Camila was about 2 months pregnant with the twins by that point. We knew that once she got further along, she wasn't going to be able to be there as much, but I wanted her there to start off on the right foot.
Daisy, I was excited to get out on the road. I'd never toured before. My album was doing all right. I was getting some good attention, and Honeycomb was helping my album sell a bit better, too.
Graham, we were all happy to have Daisy with us. Daisy could do the hang. Daisy was a cool chick. We were in that period of time when you're doing radio spots and photo shoots and your song just keeps climbing higher and higher, selling better and better. I got recognized a few times. People had been recognizing Billy for a while, but now they were starting to know me and Karen a bit too. I'd be walking down the street and see somebody with a Sick shirt on. So I didn't care who they put me out on tour with, as long as things kept going the way they were going.
We played our first show in Nashville at the Exit Inn, and my attitude was to include Daisy as I would include anybody else that was opening for us. We were used to being the opening band, and now we were the headliner. So I wanted to be as inclusive to her as other bands have been to us, personal feelings aside.
Karen, we were all backstage before our first show, before Daisy's supposed to go out there. And Daisy's snorting a few lines. Warren's getting a massage from some groupie that somehow worked her way back with us. Eddie and Pete are doing whatever. Billy's off by himself. Graham and I are talking. I think it was that show. Graham had trimmed his beard, and you could see how handsome he was underneath all that scruff. And then there's a knock at the door, and it's Camila and Julia. They'd come to say goodnight to Billy. The second Daisy sees Camila and Julia, she puts the dope in a drawer, cleans her nose, puts down her glass of brandy or whiskey or whatever she's drinking. It was the first time I saw any awareness from her. Like, maybe she didn't live on another planet. She shook Camila's hand and she waved at Julia. I remember she called her chickadee. And then it was time for Daisy to go on, and she said, "Wish me luck." Everyone else was too busy doing their own thing to even pay attention, but not Camila. She wished her luck, and she was so sincere about it.
Camila. The first time I met Daisy Jones, I did not know what to think of her. She seemed really scattered, but also very sweet. I knew Billy didn't like her, but I also didn't think his opinion meant I couldn't have my own. But I mean, undeniably gorgeous. Just as pretty, maybe even prettier than in the magazines.
I went out on stage first, opening up in Nashville, and I was nervous. I'm not normally a very nervous person, but I could feel it in my body, my nerves. And I was maybe too coked up. I walked out onto that stage expecting to see all these people waiting for the six. But a lot of the crowd was excited just to see me. They were there for me. I was wearing a black halter dress and my gold bangles and my gold hoops. Except for rehearsals, that was the first time I went onto a stage by myself with just my backing band that Hank had put together. It was the first time I heard a crowd that big roar for me. All these people coming together, looking and sounding like a living being, this booming, bellowing, living thing. Once I felt that, I wanted to feel that all the time.
Graham. Daisy played a good show. She had a great voice. Her songs weren't bad. She was somebody that could hold a crowd. And by the time we got out there, the audience was excited. They were already having a good time.
Warren. You could smell the grass in every corner of the place. Could barely see the back of the crowd through the smoke.
The moment we stepped foot onto the stage, you could tell the people that were there. It was a different group of people than our first tour. There were a lot more of them, for starters. The original fans were still there, but now we had teenagers and parents. Now we had a lot of women.
I stood there in front of that crowd, stone sober, feeling their excitement, knowing Honeycomb was heading for the top 10. And I knew I had those people in the palm of my hand. I knew they wanted to like us. They already liked us. I didn't have to win them over. I stood on that stage, and we'd already won.
Eddie. We really pulled out the stops that night. Put it all out there on the floor for them.
At the end of the show, I said, "What do you all say I bring Daisy Jones back out here and we play Honeycomb for you?"
The crowd went crazy. The whole place started rumbling.
I could feel my microphone vibrating as they screamed and stomped their feet. I thought, holy shit, we're rock stars.
By the end of 1976, Honeycomb had peaked at number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. The band, along with Daisy, had performed the song on Don Kirshner's rock concert and The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. They had finished up their North American tour dates and were gearing up for the short European leg of the tour. Camila Dunn, now 6 months pregnant, returned with Julia to Los Angeles.
Billy. I couldn't make Camila and Julia stay out on the road with me indefinitely. I had to take control of it myself.
Camila, I knew him well enough to know when I needed to stay and when it was okay to go.
The first night without them was hard. I remember sitting on my suite balcony after the show, hearing all the chaos outside and wanting to be a part of it. There was this voice in my head saying, "You can't do this. You can't stay sober for much longer." I ended up calling Teddy. It was the early hours of the morning, but it was only about dinner time for him. I made up something to talk to him about. I think we ended up discussing whether he should marry Yasmin. He was worried he was too old for her. I told him to go for it anyway. By the end of the call, I was feeling tired. I knew I could go right to sleep, live to see another day. When we got off the phone, Teddy said, "You feeling all right now, Billy?" I said, "Yeah, I am." After I had that first night under my belt, I felt a little bit better. I stuck to my routine. I stayed away from the partying. When the show was over, I went back to my hotel room and I'd listen to some records, or I'd go get a decaf coffee and read the paper at a diner. Sometimes Pete or Graham would join me, although most of the time, God knows, Graham was just trailing after Karen somewhere. But I just kept on like I'd been doing when Camila and Julia had been with me, towing the line.
Graham. It was the same when Camila was there or when she wasn't there. Billy was with the band when there was work to be done, and Daisy was with us when there was partying to be done. And never the two shall meet, or whatever it is they say.
Rod. Right before we're heading out to Sweden, I told Billy and Graham that Runner was considering extending their tour once the European leg was done. I asked them what they thought of tacking on a couple more weeks once they got back to the States. It was a non-starter. Camila was due around when we'd be getting back. Billy felt like he was cutting it close as it was.
It was a 2-second conversation. Would I have liked to have continued the tour? Of course. Did it put us in a tough spot that Billy had to go home? Yeah. But he had to go home. End of discussion.
Warren. All of us wanted to do more dates, but we couldn't perform without Billy. You can plug in some guitarists for a few shows, a keyboardist, but you can't replace Billy.
We were doing sold-out shows, and a lot of that was my doing. Meanwhile, the band's album was selling a lot more than mine. Theirs was better than mine, so it made sense. But when it came to the live show, a lot of people really were coming to see me. And even some of the ones that didn't care who I was before they got there left with a Daisy Jones t-shirt. I had real buzz, and I'd been working on some good songs of my own. I had one, super simple melody, not very complex, but it was good. It was called When You Fly Low. I'd written it about selling yourself short, about how some people try to keep you small. They want you humble, want to atrophy that muscle, want to stunt the hustle, get you to call uncle, to keep you flying low. I'd been saying to Hank that it was time to talk to Teddy about a new album, and Hank kept saying that I should slow down. I got the impression that he thought I was asking too much, like I thought I deserved more than I did. Our relationship was not in a good place. I should never have been with a guy like that. That's one thing they don't mention when they tell you to stay away from drugs. They don't say drugs will have you sleeping with some real jerks, but they should. And I had let Hank into every part of my life. He often stood between me and Teddy. He was the one who hired my entire band. My money was funneling through him. And he was in my bed.
Karen, when we were heading out to Stockholm, we went out on Runner's private jet.
Hank and some of the crew had flown out the day before, but I waited and hitched a ride with the band. I made it seem like I wanted to hang out with them on the plane, but I just didn't want to fly over with Hank.
Eddie. It was on the flight out that I overheard Graham talking to Karen about turning down the extension. Man, that was the first time I'd heard of it. No one had told me or Pete. We had a hit song, we were selling out shows with Daisy, lots of people making a lot of money. The band, the roadies, everybody working on our tour and at the venues. We all have to pack it in because Billy got his wife pregnant? And it's not even put up to a vote. We have to find out about it after the decision has already been made.
That was an interesting flight. I think that was the flight Warren got slapped by the stewardess. I only heard the slap, I didn't see it.
Warren. I asked her if she was a natural blonde. Lesson learned. Not all women think that's funny.
Daisy and I were in the back minding our business the majority of that flight. We had these two chairs facing each other, a couple cocktails, looking out the window. I remember Daisy pulled out a pill box and knocked back two pills, washed them down with a sip of her drink. She'd started wearing all those bangles by then, as many as would fit on her arms. Everything clinked when she moved. So as Daisy is putting her pill box back in her pocket, her bangles start clanging, and I made a joke about how they were built-in tambourines. And she thought that was cool. She took a pen and wrote it down on her hand. And then when she put the pen away, she took out the pill box again and took two more pills from it and put them in her mouth. I said, Daisy, you just took two. She said, I did. I said, yeah. She just shrugged and swallowed them. I said, come on, don't be one of those people.
I was irritated by that. I shoved the pill box in her hand. I said, take them if you're so worried about it. I don't even need them.
She threw the pills at me.
But the moment I handed the pill box over to her and I saw her put it in her back pocket, I started panicking. The Dexies were one thing. That was fine. I could snort coke if I needed to. But I could not sleep without the Secanols.
It surprised me how easy it was for her to just hand it all over and stop.
When we got to the hotel, Hank was already in my room. I said, I ran out of Reds. He just nodded and picked up the phone. By the time I wanted to go to sleep, I had another bottle in my hand. It depressed me how easy it was. Don't get me wrong, I wanted the pills, I needed the pills, but it was just so boring, so repetitive. Having any narcotic I needed at any time, nobody really stopping me. As I fell asleep that night, I think I was still holding a brandy glass. I heard myself say, Hank, I don't want to be with you anymore. At first, I thought there was another woman in the room saying those words, but then I realized I was saying them. Hank told me to go to sleep, and I didn't so much fall asleep as feel like I was disappearing. When I woke up in the morning, I remembered what had happened. I felt embarrassed, but also sort of relieved to have actually verbalized it. I said to Hank, we should talk about what I said last night. And he said, you didn't say anything last night. I said, I told you I didn't want to be with you. He just shrugged and said, yeah, but you say that all the time when you're falling asleep. I had no idea.
Graham, it was pretty clear to everybody that Daisy needed to drop Hank.
Rod, there are a lot of slimy managers out there, and they make the rest of us look bad. Hank was taking advantage of Daisy clear as day. Somebody needed to be looking out for her. I said, Daisy, if you need help, I'm here.
I think Daisy saw what Rod was doing for us, the way he made sure everything was taken care of. Rod was the first guy to tell anybody that we were going to rule the world. He wasn't telling us to be happy with what we had and to keep our mouth shut. And not to be a jerk, but he wasn't sleeping with us and keeping us high as fuck so we didn't know our heads from our tails. I told Daisy, leave Hank and team up with Rod. He's got you covered.
I was already doing so much for Daisy anyway. I took the Rolling Stone to see the show. They were sending Jonah Berg out to come watch the set and then hang out afterward. It was a potential cover. I made a point of including Daisy in that. I didn't have to. I could have pushed for it to be just a story on the band, but I figured what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
The day that Jonah Berg was coming, we were in Glasgow.
I was stupid. I picked a fight with Hank right after soundcheck that day.
Graham had come over to my room that afternoon to bring me one of my suitcases. Somehow my things had ended up with his stuff. He was standing in the hotel hallway, at my door, holding a duffel bag of my bras and underwear. He said, "I believe this is yours." I grabbed it from him and rolled my eyes at him. I said, "Oh, I bet you just love having your hands on my panties." I was just joking around, but he shook his head and he said, "If I get my hands on those panties, I want to have earned it the old-fashioned way." I laughed and said, "Get out of here." And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And he walked back to his room. But when I shut the door, I don't know.
I broke it to Hank when it was just the two of us in my hotel room. He was putting his arms around me, and I was done with it. I kept snapping at him, and he asked me what my problem was, and I said, "I think it's time we part ways." Hank tried to ignore me a few times, kept telling me I didn't know what I was saying, so I said it really clear. "Hank, you're fired. You should leave." Well, he heard it that time.
Billy and I were planning on going out to grab a bite. I'd bet him he wouldn't eat haggis.
Hank got in my face. He was so angry, and he was standing so close to me that as he spoke, his spit landed on my shoulder. He said, "You'd still just be screwing rock stars if I hadn't found you." When I didn't say anything back to him, Hank cornered me up against the wall. I didn't know what he was going to do. I'm not sure he knew what he was going to do. When you're in a situation like that, when you have a man looming over you, it's as if every decision you made to lead to that moment, alone with a man you don't trust, flashes before your eyes. Something tells me men don't do that same thing. When they are standing there threatening a woman, I doubt they count every wrong step they made to become the asshole they are, but they should. My body was stick straight. I felt sort of shockingly sober, and I put my arms out in front of me, holding on to whatever space I could try to defend. Hank was staring right into my eyes. I don't even know if I was even breathing. And then Hank punched the wall and walked out of the room, slamming the door on his way out. After he left, I triple locked the door behind him. He yelled something in the hall, but I couldn't make it out. I just sat on the bed. He never came back.
I was walking out of my room to go meet Graham when I saw Hank Allen coming out of Daisy's room muttering, "That fucking bitch." But he seemed to be calming down, so I was thinking I should let it go. Then I saw him stop and turn like he was going to go back into Daisy's room. I could tell he was trouble right then. You can see it in somebody's gait, you know, hands balled up into fists, jaw tight and all that. I caught his eye and he saw me. We looked at each other for a moment. I shook my head to say that would be the wrong move. He kept looking at me, then he looked down at the ground and walked out. When he was gone, I knocked on Daisy's door. I said, "It's Billy." It took a moment, but she opened the door. She was wearing a navy dress, that kind where the sleeves are off the shoulders. I knew people always talked about how blue Daisy's eyes were, but that day was the first time I really noticed them. They were so blue. You know what they looked like? They looked like the middle of the ocean. Not the shoreline, not that light blue. They looked like the dark blue of the middle of the ocean, like deep water. I said, "Are you okay?" She looked sad, which I'd never really seen before, and she said, "Yeah, thank you." I said, "If you need to talk," I wasn't sure how I could really help, but I figured I should offer all the same. She said, "Nope, that's all right."
I didn't realize just how much of a wall Billy put up around himself when he was near me until that moment when suddenly there was no wall. Like how you don't register you're hearing the hum of a car engine until it's turned off. But I looked him in the eye then, and I saw the real Billy. I realized I'd been looking at this guarded, cold version of him the whole time up until then. I thought, it might be nice to know this Billy. But then it was over. Just 1 second of realness from him, and then poof, gone the way it came.
I was waiting for Billy when my phone rang.
I don't know why it was that day that I decided to do it.
I said hi, and Karen just said hi.
We were sort of quiet for a second, and then I said, how come you've never made a move on me? I could hear him drinking a beer. I could hear him take a sip. He said, I don't take shots I know I'll miss. It was out of my mouth before I decided to say it. I said, I don't think you'll miss, Dunn. And then as soon as I said it, there was a dial tone.
I have never run anywhere faster than down that hall to her room.
3 seconds later, that's not an exaggeration, there's a knock on my door. I opened it, and Graham was out of breath. A tiny run down the hall, and he was out of breath.
I looked right at her. She was so gorgeous, those thick eyebrows. I'm a sucker for a girl with thick eyebrows. I said, what are you saying to me?
I said, just go for it, Graham.
I stepped right into her room. I shut the door behind me, and I grabbed that woman and kissed her good. You don't usually wake up in the morning and think, this is going to be one of the most exciting days of my life, but that day was. That day with Karen. That was one of them.
Warren, here's something I never told anyone. No, this is good. You're going to like this. When we were doing our show in Glasgow, sometime after soundcheck, I'm taking one of my beer naps, which is what I would call having a beer and taking a nap. And I wake up because Karen is having sex with somebody in the next room. I can't even sleep, it's so loud. I never found out who it was, but I did see her being a little flirty with our lighting tech, so... Anyway, I think Karen had a thing with bones.
After I left Daisy, I tried to find Graham for lunch, but he wasn't anywhere.
When it was time to leave to get down to the venue, Karen made me sneak out her door, go to my room, change, and then meet her at the elevators.
I didn't want anyone to know anything.
By the time we all got backstage, everybody was running around like chickens with their heads cut off because Daisy's band was nowhere to be found.
Eddie. Apparently, Hank went down to the Apollo on his way out of town and took all 5 of Daisy's band members out with him. They just up and left.
It was such a low blow.
Nothing was supposed to come before the music. Our job was to go out there and play for the audience, no matter what personal shit was going on.
My band had walked out. Just walked out. I didn't know what to do.
Hank Allen, former manager Daisy Jones. All I care to say is that Daisy Jones and I had a strictly professional relationship from 1974 to 1977, which was mutually terminated due to difference of opinion regarding the trajectory of her career. I continue to wish her the best.
Billy, I find Rod and he's already in damage control mode. I said to him, is it really that bad if Daisy doesn't play one night? Then I realized, as I said that he was probably her manager now. And so, you know, to him, yeah, it was.
Jonah Berg was in the audience from Rolling Stone.
Everybody was trying to figure out what to do, but Graham is trying to catch my eye every second no one's looking. I was laughing to myself, thinking, we're supposed to be trying to solve a problem here.
I couldn't stop looking at Karen.
Graham was always the guy I would talk to about stuff. And that night I found myself wanting to tell him about this great afternoon I had. It was like I wanted to talk to him about him.
Daisy, I said to Rod, maybe I should go out there on my own. I didn't want to give up. I wanted to do something.
Eddie. Rod had suggested that Graham go out there with Daisy and the two of them do a few acoustic versions of some of the songs from her album. But Graham wasn't really paying attention. I said, I can do it.
Rod, I sent Daisy and Eddie out there with no idea what was going to happen. And the whole time I'm watching them walk out to the mic like a cat on hot bricks.
Eddie and I did a few songs. Really pared down, just his guitar and me singing. I think we did One Fine Day and Until You're Home. It was fine, but We didn't blow anybody away. And I knew Rolling Stone was out there, and I needed to make a good impression, so on the last song, I decided to go off script.
Daisy leaned over to me, and she gave me this vague beat and a key, and told me to come up with something. That was it. Just come up with something. I did my best, you know what I mean? You can't exactly make up a song on the fly like that.
I was trying to get Eddie to play something I could sing my new song to. I wanted to sing When You Fly Low. He started, and I sang a few bars, trying to get into a rhythm with him, but